University, the voice of Reichman University.
Beyond the uniform. Stories of strength, resilience, and rising to the occasion. With Rachel Safty and Rachel Iskandry.
Hey, it's Rachel Safty.
And Rachel Iskandry.
And welcome to the Beyond the Uniform podcast on Audioversity, where we tell you the untold stories of the heroes of Israel.
Today, we have a special guest that was born and raised in the Netherlands as a Christian and found out about his Jewish identity at just 17 years old.
Little did he know that the worst terror attack in the history of Israel would happen, and he would end up fighting in a war at just 24 years old. Levi, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Levi, tell us a bit about where you grew up.
So, I was born in a small village in the Netherlands named Almelo. It's 5 minutes from the German border. And it's basically, if you picture like an idyllic village, like a farmer's village, where it's only small houses, and I think we're around less than 50,000 people, and it's like in the city center, everyone knows each other, you know, all the families, and I had a great childhood. Yeah, it's an amazing place to grow up.
And then you found out you're Jewish, right? You grew up Christian and eventually found out you're Jewish. How was that?
Right, so that is one crazy story which I love to tell. So I was raised Christian, like culturally Christian, not per se religious. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 17 years old, my grandmother got a letter from the German government, basically stating that she deserves to be compensated by the German government because of what happened in the war. Because of what happened, and this was a very common phenomenon at the time, that my great-grandmother with my grandmother, who was 4 years old at the time, were persecuted during the war for being Jewish. And they ended up being the sole survivors of my family. And then they moved back to the Netherlands. And then my great-grandmother basically hid her identity. She didn't tell my grandma. Again, she was 4 years old. She doesn't remember anything. And she converted to Christianity and got remarried. And that was basically the end of the story until the German government, they have a special committee for this. Every a few years, they mm-hmm. check to find additional documents of people who were hurt by the war. So they found my great-grandmother's name, and that all her brothers, sisters, parents, everyone perished in the war because they were registered Jewish. So that's why they reached out to us. And we in the beginning didn't understand why, because like, why would they persecute Christians, right? So I speak a bit of German myself, so I took it upon myself to go to Germany and go to these institutions and basically ask them, what does this mean? And that's when I found out that we're registered Jewish. So that's how we found out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were you happy when you found out about it? Like, what was the feeling?
It's a lot of mixed feelings, I think. Again, also, try to picture that my community is 5 minutes from the German border. So you can imagine what happened during the war. There was no Jewish presence left at all. Like nothing. Only graveyards.
Right.
So that... I didn't know anything about Judaism, basically. You know it exists, but you don't interact with it in your day-to-day life. Right,
because it's we don't have part of it.
Exactly. So when I find out, in the beginning, it's like a weird piece of trivia. I was thinking, okay, so I have distant Jewish relatives, and then it turns out I'm Jewish, but it didn't mean anything to me. But I did want to explore it further. It was more like a need to know more, mm-hmm. Because I did feel like, well, it's my heritage, so I wanted to know about my heritage in general. So I decided to get in touch with a rabbi, because I literally just Googled Jewish connections in the Netherlands. I didn't know anything, right? And then I got to Beit Chabad, and I learned about their mission is basically to promote and Judaism around the world, right? So I got in touch with them and told them my story. And then the rabbi was like, yo, you should come. You should come for Shabbat, and like I'll help you out, and I'll explain what it means to be Jewish. Yeah, so he invited me over. So I went to the other side of the country, because that was the closest Jewish community to my house. Was like a 40-minute drive.
The spiritual road trip.
Yes, literally. Literally. So I went to his community, and he, of course, he welcomed me with open arms. And that's when I did my first Shabbat. I met Bar Mitzvah when I was 18 years old at this synagogue. And that just, it awakened something in me that was missing. And from there on out, I started to further explore Judaism and took it from there.
And how did you end up in Israel? Like, what was the process, you know, from your first Shabbat ever in the Netherlands with the rabbi across the country to ending up in Israel? What made you come completely change your life and come here?
Right. So, of course, these are decisions you don't take overnight.
Of course not. We all know that as immigrants.
Exactly.
Of course.
And everyone has their own way. I feel like it's very gradual. So what happened to me is I found out about my Jewish ancestry when I was 17. I did my bar mitzvah, and this whole story happened when I was 18 in the synagogue. Then a few months later, I finished high school, which is also a big moment where me and my friends were exploring universities, planning the next phase of our lives together, mm-hmm. and something still felt off. Again, with all this information that I just acquired or learned about and about Judaism, and I felt something was still missing. And then I started exploring the options of, first of all, traveling to Israel. Like, I've been here a couple of times, but never with this knowledge or this ancestral link. So that's when I thought it would be a great idea to travel in Israel first. So that's when I did the Taglit program, or Birthright in English. And that basically opened the door for me to, it was the first time I really was in Israel by myself and learning a lot about Israel. So that was definitely the first motivator.
That's actually really interesting that you mentioned Taglit. For like those that don't know, Taglit is, I mean, it was life-changing for me. There's a group of people from the Netherlands or Brazil in my case, and they bring in soldiers, right? Did you also have soldiers?
That's right. Yes.
Amazing. So I was one of the soldiers that was connected to this group, this delegation of young Jewish Brazilians, very similar to, I mean, your story is very special, but people that are, want to come and get to know Israel.
To learn, to experience the culture.
Develop their Jewish identity in any way. And I, as Brazilian Israeli, someone who was born and raised in Brazil, never thought I would even move to Israel. I've always had this sort of identity crisis in a way of what am I, who am I, Brazilian, Israeli.
Of course.
As we all know, when we're there, we're considered Israeli. When we're here, we're considered Brazilian. And so in Taglit, it was the first time where I answered this huge, big question of my life. It was on a day after we had just been to the Kotel, to the Western Wall. And one of the guys that was one of the Brazilians that was in Taglit with me, he was telling about his experience at the Kotel and that he went to get a kippah and he heard someone speaking Portuguese. And he asked the guy, Are you Brazilian? And he said, I'm Jewish. That was his answer. And the moment he told me this story, I had this sort of conclusion. I had this answer that for so long I was yearning for, Brazilian, Israeli, what defines me? And first and foremost, I'm Jewish. That's what I am. So Taglit is extremely, extremely impactful. I know so many people that eventually made Aliyah and moved to Israel after, they did Taglit and that was their first experience. So that's amazing that you did that.
So tell us a little bit about your decision to draft. How does that happen post Taglit, post this incredible life-changing experience? What are the steps that went into, I'm going to move to Israel permanently?
Right, I think I personally took like the most extreme route you can take as a person because I didn't know anything. First of all, I didn't know anything about Judaism, right? I started learning very slowly, but it takes time. And then after Taglit and finishing high school, then I made the decision to first of all come to Israel and study the language because I didn't speak a word of Hebrew.
Right.
Because I didn't speak Hebrew at home. That's a perk that some other immigrants do have because they know Hebrew from home. Mm-hmm. I did not have that. So
and Hebrew is not an easy language to learn.
Not at all.
Right. So I went to a kibbutz. For those who don't know, that's a community in Israel where people live in a very communal, like they share everything basically. So I had to work 4 hours a day and then I could study with them 4 hours a day. And I lived like this for 6 months. And it was my first big encounter with Jewish culture and Israeli culture, basically, mm-hmm. after moving here. And that really opened my eyes. And it was a wonderful experience. So while I was in the stage of learning Hebrew, I realized, okay, I think I'm here to stay.
Wow.
And if I'm here to stay, then I will like draft like everyone else. Of course, you have this passion to give to the country and contribute to the army. But for me personally, mostly it was a motivator, which was like, if everyone has to do it, who am I not to do it?
Yeah, for those who don't know, Israel has a mandatory drafting law. At the age of 18, every citizen of Israel drafts to the army.
Men and women. I just, out of curiosity, what did you work with at the kibbutz?
So I took care of all the green life in the
agriculture.
Agriculture, but more for aesthetic reasons. So we would like have big chainsaws. We would cut up the palm trees, landscaping. But for the whole area,
wow.
Long days, waking up 4 a.m, working till let's say 4 or 5 hours of work, and then in the morning going to my Ulpan classes, to my Hebrew classes.
This is really the Israel experience.
they put me to work. It's very Israeli indeed. So I definitely developed a work ethic as well, which definitely helped. And from there, I was 20 years old at the time. And so even the people told me, if you wait 6 more months when you turn 21, you don't have to draft. And I told them, no, I want to. So I had to go through a bureaucratic mess as well in order to be able to draft. Mm-hmm. But once you get through that phase, once you're actually in uniform, that's like a whole different process altogether. So first I made my way to the army. They did a Hebrew test. Of course, my Hebrew was not good enough, which is not surprising. So I did another Hebrew course in the army.
You were also in Michvelon?
Yes.
And Rachel, you as well?
No, I wasn't in Michvelon. I don't know how they missed me in the system, but I got a good enough score on my test that I didn't have to do additional Hebrew courses. I definitely struggled, but we made it.
Wow, this is interesting. For those of you that don't know, Michvelon is the base where, you know, they take, it's the base for basic training and a basic course where immigrants and, you know, maybe Israeli Arabs, Bedouins, there were a lot of people from so many different cultures go there to learn Hebrew, basically. And so I was also there. It was... Wow, what an experience. I mean, it's the three first months of your army experience, but there's like no Israelis. It's just, I mean, everyone's Israeli, but it's just a bunch of immigrants.
It's just one big melting pot of everyone that lands in this country.
We have Bedouins, we have Druze, we have Russians, we have Ukrainians, we have French, we have Americans, everyone. So it was a...
It's a three-month experience. It's long.
It's long. It's long.
It's very intensive.
And it's included with... It's both learning Hebrew, like the classes, I don't know how it was for you. Mm-hmm. It was probably pretty similar, but like you wake up in the morning, army, you know, you're cleaning your room, everything. We all know that. First morning lesson, you know, Hebrew, aleph bet, you're learning the alphabet. Second morning lesson, how to, you know, put up your gun together. Like, it's such an insane concept. Like, you're in the army, but you're also sitting in a classroom learning Hebrew. So how is that for you?
Yeah, that was very surreal. I feel like every time, like, I am in a certain phase of, again, taking all the way back to when I learned about Judaism, then I was like, okay, now I want to learn more. And from learning more, I was like, okay, now I want to travel in Israel. From traveling in Israel, I went to moving to Israel. From moving to Israel, I went to joining the army. And then when you're actually in the army, so for me, in Michvelon was the first interaction with, like, I didn't know anything about the army, like no specifics. So they taught me about the different units that are in the army, the kind of jobs that you could have, how good of a Hebrew you need in order to go to certain units, which gives you motivation. They teach you the basics of how to take care of yourself, for example. Like, I forgot even the word in English, misdar.
Yeah,
how it's, you translate. It's like every
organization.
Single, yes. So let's say in the morning when you wake up, you have specific times when you have to be ready. You have to all your
they
equipment.
They teach you discipline, right?
It's, yes,
I mean,
that's the
they,
key.
You know, they we wake up in the morning. We have to undo our beds and make and remake our beds every day. You know, we don't actually have to do that on our day to day lives.
Of course,
but it's
you're
the
like
army.
Folding it the specific way and you putting in your uniform the correct way,
and you clean the room every day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like details matter. That's what they try to ingrain into you. So it was at this phase where I started to improve my Hebrew. And of course, you get to know people who walked a similar path to yours, but it's always different stories, which is
of
nice.
Course.
Different nationalities, different languages.
I mean, you were a lone soldier.
Right.
Yeah.
So...
Can you explain to people what that means a bit?
Of course. So basically, a lone soldier is someone who drafted to the Israeli army and their immediate family is not in Israel. So that would be parents or if they're the caretakers, whoever it might be. So they are considered lone soldiers and they have extra rights. an extra benefit, because of course being in a country and serving the country when you don't have an immediate support system,
your mom and dad aren't here,
that's very tough.
I was also a lone soldier, but unlike Levi, I did Garin Tzabal, which is a program that from the beginning, before you even make your official move to Israel, the program helps you and introduces you and tells you where you're going to be situated, where you're going to be living. And mm-hmm. and you live with a bunch of other lone soldiers your age and from your specific area. It could be the United States, Canada, South America, whatever it is. So for me, that was kind of my introduction to Israel. It was like a couple months of living with this program and here, let me teach you about this job. Let me teach you about this. So I can't imagine like not having that and just army.
So you had kind of like a support system of other lone soldiers just like you living together and more of a support.
For me, it was an incredible experience. Like till this day, I talk so fondly about it. But it's definitely difficult. It's not an easy transition, easy move.
Of course.
Easy choice.
And Levi, you were in combat. You were a combat soldier.
Right. So at the end of the Hebrew course, I decided that it would be the most meaningful way I could spend my time in the service would be through combat.
Wow.
So I did a, first of all, my parents had to sign a document saying that I can go to combat because I'm an only child.
Right.
So by Israeli law, I'm not allowed to draft, like to go to a combat unit, only to office jobs, let's say. So they wouldn't let me go at first. So I got very angry.
And that is because they don't want parents to lose their only child?
Also, but it's mostly to preserve bloodlines. Because if my if I'm an only child and my last name would die with me, right? Hypothetically. So that's the reason why. This fun fact also, when there's two brothers who are in the same unit, they cannot serve together as well. Like if there's a conflict, they cannot be in the same area together or the same team.
They can't be in the same team.
In case something happens to the both of them together, same story, bloodline. Wow. So yeah, so I couldn't draft to a combat position. So I called my parents. Also, I would like you to imagine being my mom for a second.
I was thinking the
first,
same. I was
the strongest woman in the world.
Yes.
Exactly.
But again, from all the way back, first of all, learning about Judaism and then telling her I'm attached to Judaism and then traveling to Israel, then moving to Israel, and then joining the army and then telling her I want to go to a combat position.
You really turned this woman's world upside down.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. But she is very acceptive and she loves what I'm doing. And
has she been to Israel? Have your parents visited?
Yes, actually she has. Moving forward in the story a little bit, but she surprised me and she came to my, there's a march we have to do at the end of training, 55 kilometers with 60% body weight. And my parents were waiting for me at the end as a surprise. Yes,
incredible.
They flew over and it was amazing. So that just shows how supportive they are of me.
Wow.
I'm sure that was like one of the best moments that you could have experienced after everything.
It's indescribable. It really is.
Wow. So how was the process of, you know, wanting to join a combat unit? And then you told your parents, they were in shock at first probably.
Right.
But then eventually they became supportive?
Yes, they were supportive from the start, mm-hmm. but I definitely had to come up with a good story. Like they wanted to make sure I didn't do this like on an impulse. They wanted mm-hmm. to make sure I knew what I was doing and I was really going to move forward with this and take care of myself.
Right, you know, like any good parent, they were like, are you sure about this one?
Yes, they just wanted to make sure. And I could respect that. So we had a very long conversation and they eventually agreed. They signed all the documents. And then I went to an infantry brigade. Called Nachal, for those who might know. It's just regular infantry. And then also within infantry, I did a tryout for, you could say like in English, like a reconnaissance battalion. And I got accepted for that. So I spent my whole service in this unit.
Wow, amazing. And speaking of the army and your service, if we could, you know, talk a bit about the current war that we're in and maybe ask you, where were you on October 7th? And how has your life been for the past year?
Great question. First of all, so I drafted, just for timetable-wise, I drafted in September of 2020. I got released in 2023, let's say a few months before the war.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, on the 7th of October, I was in the Netherlands visiting my parents before the start of the academic year. I was supposed to start studying. But then I woke up that morning and I had like four missed calls from my commander because it was early in the morning. And I called him back. And I said, what's going on? He's like, no, we're at war. Like, I got you a plane. You're on your way back.
The ticket tomorrow. Has been booked.
Yes, there's no questions. I was supposed to fly back only, like, I'd say 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later.
Wow.
So then I went downstairs and I looked my parents in the eyes and I was like, yeah, it's happening and I'm going back. And
at this point, were you guys kind of aware of what was happening? Like, I know that a little bit was on the media, the news, but not so much, like not the extent of what would happen.
Exactly. I would say, like, in the 7th of October, the morning itself. So I don't know how, for example, how you experienced it, but like...
I woke up to sirens. I was right. Like, good morning, 6:30
in the morning. I was in Brazil. I was also...
Wow. So maybe you can to relate what I'm about to tell, because we understood there was things going on in the south, like sirens going off, people running to their shelters. But sadly, this is a very common occurrence. This was not weird in a way. So yes, we thought something big was going on. But I think even until like 12 o'clock in the afternoon that day, no one understood the gravity of the situation.
Correct.
And it's also interesting because you were in the Netherlands, like you were in Europe. So the time zone is relatively close. It's probably 1 or 2, maybe 3 hours.
1 hour, yes.
One hour, yeah. So I was in Brazil and I woke up on that Saturday at 10 a.m. in Brazil and it was already 4 p.m. in Israel.
Wow.
So the first thing I saw was the video of Naama Levy, who is still a hostage in Gaza, with blood on her sweatpants, being dragged by a terrorist already inside of Gaza.
Yeah.
And so I think I kind of, you know, had the shock as everyone else did. But, you know, I woke up and I already saw it was 4 p.m. here. So there was already more information. And same thing, I was actually in my conscripted service. I wasn't in reserves yet.
Yep.
I was supposed to finish in 3 months. And I texted it was the opposite for me. I actually texted my commander saying, I'm coming back. And he was like, stay there. It's too dangerous. It's a mess.
Right.
But that's crazy. And right away, you felt like, I'm going, I have to go. How was the process of telling your parents?
Right. Even looking back, it's very surreal because it's an experience you've, of course, never had to experience before. I would say specifically because of all the training we've been through and at the end of your service, how it works in combat, specifically in our type of units like that are a bit more elite. At the end of your mandatory service, they tell you what your job will be in reserve duty. Mm. And then usually you show up, let's say once a year for a week to train what you're going to do in case of an emergency and you get called up. So we got a role assigned to us. We knew what we're going to do. We never had the opportunity to practice, of course, because the war happened only a couple of months after our release.
Right.
So this information was there. So once I realized I was called back, I got a plane ticket. Like in my head, I'm already like focusing, mentally preparing for what's ahead because no one knows what's ahead of us. But I knew what our job would entail. So it was more of saying goodbye to my parents properly. That was very, very hard. Like also not knowing, if I'll see them again.
Like,
no one knows what was in store for us at the time. So that was definitely a very, very hard moment.
And were you able to be with your team from your service during reserves? Because I know a lot of people end up in a completely different unit in reserves.
Right. So actually when my commander called me, I told him I'm definitely coming back, but only if I join our team. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the more beautiful things in the unit that I was in, which is a privilege because it's not common, like you just mentioned. That from day one of basic training till I finish my reserve duty when I'm 40 years old, I'm with the same 15 guys.
Wow. It's the most incredible like sense of brotherhood, I feel like. I mean, I didn't experience anything like it, but tell us a little bit about that also, like this relationship that you formed with these people.
Right. First of all, that relationship on up on itself is already amazing and unique and incredible. But also for me as an outsider coming to Israel, and then in the beginning, really struggling with culture and language and trying to adapt and adjust and being with these guys and just also like failing a lot to get your point across. Also because of language barriers, but also culturally.
Wow. That is the hardest feeling when you're trying to express yourself, but you just don't have enough vocabulary in this language to get your point across.
It's so frustrating. It's like... Wow. I know exactly what I want to say, and I have no idea how to say it.
Exactly. So every job is different, but imagine, so this situation where you're trying to get your point across, but it's, you're doing an exercise, it's the middle of the night, you haven't slept in 3 days,
yeah,
you haven't eaten in 5 days.
You only want to talk your native language. You're done.
Yes, exactly. So it came with its struggles, but yeah, at the end, specifically at the end of training, and you connect to them more and you go on missions together, right? Because in mandatory duty before the war, I would have my service in the West Bank and we would do operations, and you feel like you're doing something meaningful together, and you build a legacy together, and it creates a very connection that is very intimate. So till this day, we're still meeting up every other week whenever we can.
Wow.
Yeah, the week doesn't pass by that I don't see someone from the team.
Wow. They became,
that's incredible.
Your family.
Your family, right. Yeah. Because I don't have one in Israel, so they became my family. Wow. They took care of me instead.
That is beautiful. So beautiful.
Yeah.
How many days were you actually in reserves duty this past year?
Just short of 250, like 247, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
Yes.
That's so much. Mostly in Gaza?
Correct.
Wow.
How does this long period of being in reserves impact your relationships, your family, your mental health? Like, tell us a bit about that one.
I think that's a very good question, because there's not a lot of situations, let's say even in the world, I could compare what our soldiers have been through, because the conflict was just so long. Let's say there is a very intensive period of conflict, but it's relatively short, let's say, compared to other wars that we've had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Just people don't know how to deal with soldiers who've been in war for 9 months straight, 10 months straight, at this point, year plus. I know some people who still didn't get released from reserve duty, didn't have a single break. And then after a year, you come back home, and then you're supposed to pick up the old threads of your old life and start studying again or start working again. And it just doesn't work. And so we have to find a way to deal with that and build a framework to help people specifically who've been in such a high pressure environment, sometimes with danger of their own lives, for such a long time. So I think this is a very big problem. And again, like emphasizing the lone soldier aspect of things, when a lone soldier gets home, doesn't come home to a family who can help him out and help
fresh
him.
Fresh laundry, no hot meal.
It sounds like the small mercies in life, but they can make a difference. They can
really.
And I really miss them after being in, say, in Gaza for, let's say, a month. And
it only makes
home.
It emotionally harder. Definitely.
Yes.
Well, I remember, coming home from the army after, I don't know, 2 weeks of, not showering and showering once in a while, army food, you're exhausted, and coming home, and, my mom makes me I was with my mom here, my dad in Brazil, so I was a half-lone soldier. My rights that I would get from the army were the days, the meyuchedet, they call it, the days to visit
back home to your parents.
Exactly. But I had my mom here, cooking me a fresh meal, laundry I never had to do. So I can't even imagine how it was for you guys and how it was for you coming back from actual active war. You're in Gaza in an actual war, and coming back home and not having anyone.
I recently saw this post that someone said most of the people that are in active duty right now, whether it's like reserves or their mandatory service, have spent more nights sleeping in either Gaza or Lebanon than they have in their own beds, which is just
insane.
This past year, which is insane to think about.
It's absolutely insane. And also the amount of parents, fathers, business owners, people that lost, their livelihoods because of the war.
I mean, students, Levy, you were supposed to begin university last year.
Right.
A whole year of your life was delayed so that you could go and fight in a war. I mean, that's insane. How is it now, that you even mentioned that you have to do reserves until you're 40, right? How is it now balancing your life now, just, we all study together in the same
same degree, same year
in university? How is it balancing also this anxiety also of, maybe tomorrow I'll be called up and have to go back into Gaza? And then, you know, how am I going to do this final exam, turn in this assignment? How are you in that sense?
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that question. First of all, there's like a difference. Let's say people who are in a unit full of people who only do reserve duty, let's put it this way, they get dates beforehand. They say, okay, 2 months from now, you'll be on duty for 2 weeks and then you go home on these and these days. Mm-hmm. They have everything laid out for them. In my unit, it doesn't work that way. My commander could call me right now. He said, tomorrow morning, you're going back to base and then something will happen. We're on a very short call-up basis.
Wow.
So that's a different kind of anxiety, knowing that at any point you have to drop everything in your life to go back to reserves. So there's definitely levels to that, and that's very tough, but you don't have an alternative. I cannot pause my whole life just because maybe I'll go back to reserves. That's also one of the reasons I picked this university, I have to say, because they're very engaged with their reserve duty lone soldiers, try to help them out whenever they can, academically, but also mentally. There's a lot of ways we can get help, which is definitely amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It really is. It really is. It has helped me personally as well. And then everyone finds their own way. I mean, of course, this is applicable to me, but I would say the whole country went through, let's say, a shared trauma in a way, and everyone deals with trauma in their own way. So I know for me personally, what helps me is like staying active, staying productive, and feeling like I'm giving back to the communities that I receive from. So I volunteer a lot, specifically for lone soldiers.
You volunteering?
Right now, there's an organization called Ach Gadol, which would be Big Brother in English, where basically you get assigned to 3 or 4 lone soldiers who are about to start their journey, like the journey that you did a couple of years ago. And you basically guide them throughout the whole process.
Wow.
And you're trying to be there for them, because we didn't have that.
Yeah,
I didn't have that.
Amazing.
So try to give that back, for example.
That is so beautiful.
That's one of the things I really like and really enjoy doing. Yeah,
that's amazing. And you also mentioned maybe doing some sort of mental health organization, I remember, to help with the mental health of soldiers in general, reservists.
Right. So at the moment, I personally am trying to set up like an awareness campaign for specifically for the fact that there is it's a niche. It's like, I'll explain it this way. When you're in the army in active duty as a lone soldier, you are a lone soldier. You have extra rights, for example, because you cannot stay with your parents. You get like a small stipend to get an apartment, things like that. Or let's say one day a month where you can go home to take care of errands. But when you are in reserve duty, you don't have any other special rights. So you're still alone in the country. I just got out of the army like a couple of months before the war. They sent me to reserve duty for 9-10 months in a row, but I did not have any special rights.
You're treated like a normal Israeli everyone and everything here.
Exactly. So specifically on the long term, this can be a problem. Because we just need that extra push and extra help, that support system, because we don't have it at home.
Of course, the day that you can kind of get your life together, that one day in the army, it does so much. Like whether it's just like cleaning your house or going to the bank or doing all these things that like your car breaks down, someone needs to do it for you.
Exactly.
Like, you know.
And his car actually broke down like
that's also
a few
true.
Weeks ago.
And I had to take care of it by myself. And all these things are trivial and it's important. But to get back to your question, mental health, specifically now after war, even during, like people are still in the situation or they're still fighting. Mental health is critical.
Right.
And again, like combining all the factors of the language barrier, the culture barrier, probably people who are in the army haven't been in Israel that long statistically. So they struggle. They really struggle, and there's no framework to help them. So actually, as you are probably aware of, I actually had the opportunity to voice my concerns for the Aliyah Committee in the Knesset.
The Knesset is Israel's government, for whoever's listening.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So actually, I have a very small scoop, something I haven't shared with you guys yet. Actually, yesterday, a couple of my friends texted me screenshots. They received a text from the government stating that they are now entitled to free treatment, mental treatment.
No
because
way.
They passed a new law yesterday based on the hit on the committee that happened 2 days ago.
No way.
So
we're
making
made
an
history.
Impact. We're making impact. Well, it's not me, only me, of course. This was a big committee, a lot of players, a lot of factors. But I just arrived there as like just as a lone soldier, not part of any organization. And I just told them my story and why mental health is so important. And it seems like they listened. It's a great start, but...
I've never spoken about this either, but a couple weeks ago, my roommate and I actually went to this committee as well, and we got to share our concerns and voice everything, and we also heard so many stories about the impact that like long stretches of reserves duty have had on these soldiers, whether it's mentally, financially. Like, it's a crazy thing that unfortunately we don't know how to deal with yet, because it's history being made right now.
And it's amazing that the government is willing to listen. I mean, it's really
the
sad.
The invitation alone is.
I mean, we wish it was an obvious thing. Yes, that lone soldier rights, remain their rights when they finish their conscripted duty and they become reservists. I mean, you have until you're 40 years old. You're giving yourself to this country and you're going and you're fighting, in wars. And I mean, it should be an obvious thing, but. Congratulations for making such a difference. I mean, that's
thank you. Humble beginnings. Hopefully, there's more to come. But it's a good start.
It's amazing. It's more than a start. It's more than a start. It's beautiful. Well, I wanted to ask kind of one big final question. What is something if you could speak to anyone that's listening right now, speak to someone outside of Israel? What is something you wish people knew about Israel?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say that Israel at the moment, I mean, obviously we are in the spotlight. The whole world is watching us, and it's very easy to put people into camps and say this is right and this is wrong, this is black and this is white. So if there would be people from abroad listening and people might be aware of what's going on in Israel, maybe less aware, I would say, again, connecting back to mental health as well, like, don't forget the nuances. Like, reality is always a shade of gray. Don't forget, down the line, most people in Israel are just trying to get by, live our day-to-day lives, trying to pass our degrees, trying to build a career, trying to have a family. And we shouldn't forget about them either. For them, it's exactly the same. And we are exactly the same. We're just trying to get by, live our lives, and hopefully have a positive impact on other people, because that's what it's all about in the end.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
Thank you so much for your service and for everything you're doing for Israel and for lone soldiers. And just a few last comments I actually wanted to say. You know, you mentioned we all in this country have gone through a trauma. And I saw, it was a while ago, I think I saw a post or a video where someone said, we're not all post-trauma, we're still living the trauma. It's not over yet, you know? You still have this anxiety every day that any day your commander can call you and you're back in a war zone tomorrow, you know? We're still constantly living. I mean, the hostages are still in Gaza, you know? We still have soldiers in combat zones, and this is all still happening. That's why it's still also so hard for us to talk about October 7th, when we really stop and talk about, you know, our experiences and everything we went through in the past 14 months, it's still fresh.
You haven't even processed the majority of what you experience, and I think that it's for years to come that one day you'll wake up and you're going to be like, wow, what the heck did we just experience nationally, like on this global scale?
100%. 100%. Yeah. I think it's something we're still... We don't even know.
We don't know what's going to.
100%.
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you, Levi, so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to the Beyond the Uniform podcast on Audioversity. I'm Rachel Escandri.
And I'm Rachel Safdie. And we'll see you here back time with another untold story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Beyond the Uniform. Stories of strength, resilience, and rising to the occasion. With Rachel Safdie and Rachel Escandri.